Mr. Bomstick, reel 3.
Well, we were a little bit just by the rations. The first thing we thought about was always food, food and food. So obviously we started getting onto the tanks and they started throwing chocolates, all types of food, tin food, and all we did is eat, eat, and eat. We were eating, eating while we were sitting on the toilet. And frightened somebody else would take it away from them. So you ate it, and obviously you were eating too much. Your body wasn't used to it, you couldn't eat less. You were sitting, you were eating. You were running, you had diarrhea, you were eating. Because that's the only thing we dreamt about is to be able to have sufficient food to eat. And after a few days, the majority took out the old apartment. And we built apart from the hospital which we were there, to go to the military hospitals. And everybody had majority, 90-95% of typhus. And I don't know how long I've been in this hospital. All I know is when we came out of the hospital after, I don't know if it was weeks or days, the left hand stuff for Prague, which eventually we came over to England.
So you were being treated by the Russians in the hospital?
Yes, only the Russians, yes.
What kind of treatment did you get?
The best, what they knew about. And obviously, not everybody survived.
What happened to you at Prague?
Prague is just today we came to England. We came from Leningrad to Prague, to the airport. But before we left Prague, they had taken a photograph of us.
Who took the photograph?
The reporters. And you assembled certain groups that took 50, 60 together. And asked everybody's name. And they knew where we were going, we were going to remember England. And these photographs were published all over the world. When I arrived to England, after 2-3 weeks being in England, after I arrived in England, 2-3 weeks after, I got a letter from Buenos Aires for my uncle. The letter read, "My uncle, Windermere, England." It was a $50 permit. And in this letter, he told me that my sister's alive. So obviously, I wrote to him after. But my sister, when he told her she's buried in the belt, she was liberated and buried in the belt, and that's where she lives. And after a few weeks, you know, we stayed in London, and then we were divided off into different hospitals. Each one had a choice to go to religious, non-religious, London. You had a choice which town you want to go to. And we were left in groups of 30. Around nearly 30 bucks. So people went to Liverpool, Manchester, London, Glasgow. We went many, many places, and there's 300 of us which were divided up into 10 different hospitals. And I chose to come to Manchester because I knew it's a religious place, not so religious, but say what I'm used at home, and I came to Manchester. So obviously, I wrote to my uncle that I am, that I'm in Manchester. And my sister was in Germany. She was still in Germany. And he explained to me, he wanted to take us to Argentina, me and my sister. But unfortunately, Argentina did not allow any Jews to enter Argentina after the war. So, what we did, he wrote me a letter to tell me I should start learning Spanish in Manchester. That he's going to find a way to get me to Argentina. Me and my sister, he wanted to take us to Argentina.
Your uncle was in America, though.
In Argentina, he was. The one the family sent out.
The one you talked about earlier.
Yes, he took. He already brought over his sister. Before the war, brought already over his sister. And it was time to bring the whole family over. But my sister, when she got the papers to go to, she couldn't go to Argentina, but the one he tried to do to take us to Uruguay and smuggle us across to Argentina. And in 1947, my sister was still in Bergen-Belsen. And through the communications with the people who were handling it in Germany, she could, he had sent her a ticket for the boat, and now she missed it all. And my date of sailing was different than hers. I was going from England. And when she told me that she didn't go, I decided not to go myself finally. I stayed on in England. And my sister got married there. She married a Polish. She had twins in Bergen-Belsen. And what she did, seeing that she can't get to Argentina, she applied to go to the America. She did it the same time, and she had to wait till 1948 to get into the States. Now, the first time I saw my sister was in 1948. The Jewish Refugee Committee paid for my train fare, and somebody waited for me in Germany to take me to Bergen-Belsen to see my sister. And when I saw her there, she said, it won't be long before she goes. But while she was in Bergen-Belsen, her husband started doing some business. So by the time she left, they had a certain amount of money. But the only thing they could do is when they got to America to be able to live is to put down a deposit on a car so they could live and make a living, have it back to live.
This was the chicken farm in New Jersey.
New Jersey, yes. And 1951, I went to see her. The first time I went to America to see my sister with the intention of staying. I already knew Lily then. And I said, the only two survivors I'd like to be is my sister. And I went over to America. And there I met another boy of ours, which you must probably know Yakov Eisenberg. His uncle took him over the minute he heard that he survived and everything. But when it got to 1950, when the Korean War broke out, the time to enlist him to go to the army. And a lot of the boys went to the American army in the 50s with the Korean War. But when he heard that, he said, I'm not going to die in this war, I'm not going to fight a war now. And he came back here. And he told me the whole story. It's not easy to get a job. And oh, it's an uncle, but it's obviously not as lonesome. I looked around what I could do. And I could see, you know, it's a no place like home. Packed my bags again and came back to England.
We should say Lily is your wife who comes from Manchester.
Yes. I came back here, I knew Lily. And obviously I didn't have where to live. Okay. But, you know, the 45, we call ourselves 45, because we were liberated in 45, yes.
This is the club that you run?
Yes, but Manchester is a club called Springfield. It's Springfield. The house was called Lasky House. There used to be an MP called Lasky. And they donated the house to us. His sister used to live there. And they had a few bedrooms. And I went to live there. Started looking for a job. I found a job which was called a tavern. So it used to, was like a deli place where it used to go. But they also used to smoke salmon, their own salmon. So we were well known for, and I got a job in 1951 there for £5 a week. But I missed out a lot. I just can't think that, because I jumped from 1948 to 51 while we lived in the hospital. I lived in the hospital. This religious hospital. And
is this in Windermere or in Manchester?
Manchester. And we did nothing for about 6 months. All we did to try to educate us. We had so many English lessons because we never went to school in them. And they taught us Jewish education. And they taught us modest, which we were. And this lasted till for about 6 months, and then everybody had to try to find places for you where to go to work.
What about the question of your citizenship? Did that come up?
Not at this stage yet. Later on, which wasn't a problem at all, because you got to know English people. It's just fine for you. You apply, and I came back from America, the first thing I did, applied for English citizenship, which was granted to me. But where we got the most help we got is when we went out for the jobs. This was very hard. That's really why, because we left the hospital, we had to fend for ourselves. So we found lodgings. I remember the lodging, I lived with a few boys, charged us £2.50 a week. 46, 47, 48, 50 money. And our earnings started off, I was earning £1.25 a week. Every Monday night, we used to have to go after we finished work. There was a Jewish refugee committee in Brazen Street, Manchester. They brought your slip from the bus, what you earned on Friday, your slip from the landlady, what you're paying. It's a lucky fifth to pay to for yourself. Cleansing, whatever you want to say.
And food?
The food you were supposed to get, the £2.50 covered the food. What did they give you when you went to work in the morning for the day? They used to give you two sandwiches, tomatoes, and then packed some lunch that was wet. That's what you got. But you were working with English people. They used to send out, you know, fish and chips. Always gave you some food. And the boss itself, to see what you got for the day, always used to give you. And he sent out for his lunch to a day season. He gave me salads and lunch. And in 1951, as I said before, I tried American and didn't like it, and I came back. So I got this £5 a week job, which I lived in this house. You had to pay so much per week towards, but it left you a few pounds a week. Like, you know, so I went to England, started going out, and what we call it. And after this, while I was living in the lodgings, my first job was in the fur trade. I got a job in the fur trade, and the fellow paid me £1.25 a week in the first. And I started learning this trade. So after 2-3 years being in the trade, we lived 3-4 boys of us who were saying, why don't we start doing? He's making new clothes, and apart from making new clothes, he used to remodel new clothes. Clothes like, you know, ladies, something goes wrong with it, so on, to repair it, or remodel it, a new style comes up. We did this for, so we said, why don't we start doing the overtime while we working there, start doing Sundays, we've got a full day, instead of going to play football. So we needed a sewing machine to start, we couldn't start. So the landlady, the Lidless, she had a mother who was dealing with jewelry. We explained to him that we're going to pay him back so much every week if he could lay out. He did. And we took a machine up in the attic. This house we used to let. And we found a person who was doing this. And he started giving us work. So, whenever we had a spare hour, 2 hours, or whenever we had an hour, 2 hours, we planned it during the work. If we took to repair one or two coats, we promised that this time this coat is going to be done. So whatever happened during the week, if we had to not go to bed till 2 o'clock in the morning, we stayed up to meet the deadlock we set the goal. Because if you do that, he gave you. Again, if you let him down, you've got no chance to get. Because you didn't know where people were in Manchester. So we carried on like this while we lived there. And then this man, while we're doing all these things for him, one day said to me, how would you like to come in and work with me in the place and now make your partner? The first, obviously, I jumped to the conclusion, to the opportunity. He was also a refugee, but he came over before the war. And he lived with his mother and a lot in the house. And when I used to go around to pick up the work to do, he did the same thing, but he did already, he was established. He used to go to bigger manufacturing, and take this work and give out and make a profit on us, which he gave us. So he took me and another boy, Pinky Puffins. I don't know if he told me that. He became our partner. And then we were lucky that a season developed in the fair trade where trimmings, you know, the coats were made just with fair colors. You didn't need to make a full coat, but just a fair color, you know, sleeves, just trimmings from all the coats, all the fair trimmings. And what we did when we started for ourselves, we said, Pinky used to, he's good talking, we sent them out to all different manufacturers to try and get work. We could see if we could get more money. So we started doing all right, you know, with this trimmings and everything. And then, I can't remember the reason, Pinky left us. And I was just left with, he was called Mr. Sunday, it was always my partner. And we started doing all right in this first. But it was seasonal. First, it was all right in the winter, the fall, and then when it came in April, May, June, July, we had no work. So in Manchester, at that time, was all the refugees which came in before the war, 1937, 38, all went into the plastic business and handbags and shopping bags. So we said, why are we doing nothing? Let's try and make a few shopping bags. So obviously you need money to start, so we didn't have any money. So we found one of the refugees, which we went to see, we told him why, if he'd like to work us up some cloth, and we'll make a few shopping bags, rest from the seller, we will pay him, and we'll take cloth again. That's exactly what we did. He gave us 10 meters of cloth. I went back to my partner's house, where he was making the affairs, so it's not. This was not the first. We brought the pair of scissors and we were cutting it down. And then we went into our markets to see who's selling them. And we told them, we've got this, we're making these bags. Would you like to buy some? And we were cheaper than the wholesaler. So they came to us and started buying them. So from the 10 meters became 20 meters, and me and my partner were the only two workers. And what my partner did, we had machinists outside. He had a bicycle, and we used to have two cases, one on each side of the bicycle, straps attached to the bicycles. We used to cut in this one. We used to take out the machines. We used to bring it back and we used to finish them off and sell them. Go back for more clothes. And then we decided that this is a better business than the fair business. And then became a time that we could sell more than we could make. So we started looking for a bigger place, and we found a place, no heat, no nothing, just four walls, and we took this table we had, and we bought, instead of cutting it with a pair of scissors, which took you, we bought a knife. We called it a slot knife, not a machine yet, which we could make a lathe of 10. Cut it out, and we started bringing one or two workers to do this and this, and a half day six, 9 months. We already had 8 people working for us. And instead of a bicycle, we bought a little one for £25. So we could go to the machinist with this little one and bring him back. And then from the 8 people, we moved to bought a house. Old house. It was about £350, something like this. We accumulated some money. We moved out of this, we moved to our own house. But then it was already, we moved from the lodgings, four of us, from the hostel I was in the very home, four of us moved into a proper flat, the 50s. I lived with four boys, and then each one already started courting in the 50s. I went out with ladies, I went out running forward. And when we bought this house, I already had enough money. I always had to live. As soon as I can afford a house, I'm going to live. In 1956, a brother built a house, which when he finished, he didn't build it, but it was the house he bought, and his wife took it home, and she couldn't stand the weather here. So the doctor advised him to move to Southport, to the seaside. So he asked me for £3,800. 1956. It was three bedroom detached house. Bought this house, left the flat with the boys, and we settled down, got married, and business was very good, it took off very nicely. We were doing all right in business, and the first 3 years we had three children, and we had 57. 58 and 60, we had our three kids. And then in the 60s, 1962, we could see we expanding in a very big way. Then somebody came to me, and fellow also was making shopping bags, and he says to me, I believe you've got boys in law who are on the handbag trade. Working the Humber Street, would you like to come down to Manchester to work for me in the Humbers? Because I want to make chocolates, I want to make Humber. So he gave me an idea about Humbers that he wants to. I went down. So also at the travel mountain, I picked up two workers and I brought him down to work for him. One of them was an expert. He was very good. He knew the trade already because he's been on it since 45. He went into the Humber straight away. It's been over 10 years he knew everything. So I said to him, why are you working there during the week, in the evening? Come up to us.